The United States Court of International Trade is now in session. The Honorable Gary F. Kasten is presiding before Consolidated Court Number 21-00632, Matra Americas LLC et al. Versus the United States. Will the attorneys please state their names for the record, starting with the plaintiffs?
My name is Thomas Trundle with Stepto on behalf of Kohler.
I'm Judy Wayne at Stepto on behalf of Kohler.
Zachary Simmons, Stepto and Johnson, also on behalf of Kohler.
Will Planner, Morris Manning, and Martin on behalf of Matra.
Morning.
Emma Bond with the Department of Justice on behalf of the United States.
Mitch Purdy for the Department of Commerce.
Dan Fannerman, McKean, and Spaulding on behalf of Domtar and Patheon.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome, and in this case, the Matra Americas versus the United States, the parties know that the court has, of course, read your filings. You have answered the questions in the letter submitted October 16th, 2023. And the court has also submitted to you questions dated October 30th, 2023. So as you know, we use the oral argument really to focus on the issues. This is a chance, an opportunity for you each to respond to the answers provided by opposing counsel, and the time allotments, as you know, are 20 minutes for the plaintiffs, 20 minutes for the defendant, 20 minutes for the defendant interveners. I believe Mr. Goal has gone over this with you, and as the letter indicates, the parties can, if they want, begin their presentations with some sort of opening statement. It's not required, but it all falls within the time allocations. Without further ado, why don't we start with the plaintiffs? Thank you.
Your Honor, just one housekeeping question.
Sure.
Okay. Just to confirm, is this a public? I don't see any members of the public here. Are we to keep the public record for purposes of the hearing?
It's a public proceeding. The parties have not requested that it be closed.
I noticed that in Kohler's answers to his questions, that it's filed as a confidential document. I didn't see a public version of the answers, and I didn't think the confidential information is information. Can we refer to it publicly?
Yeah, I think.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Excuse me, Mr. Goal. So there's a static here.
I'll start.
Okay.
And you can, that's up there so you can see.
Right, I mean there's a static.
Let me turn it down a little bit.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to make sure it was okay.
Okay.
But thank you very much.
No.
All right. Yeah. Counsel, thank you.
Your Honor, thank you very much. We appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today and answer any questions, further questions you may have. Again, my name is Tom Trendle. I'm with the law firm of Steptoe & Johnson. We are here on behalf of Kohler, and just as almost as a housekeeping matter, I wanted to alert the court. We have split up the issues a bit. My colleagues, Judy Wang and Zach Simmons, will be speaking substantively on issues. Ms. Wang's testimony will be with respect to the Cohen's D questions, as they are fairly complicated and unique, I believe. And Mr. Simmons will be speaking to scope issues and other issues raised in the questions and in the responses by the government. And with that, I'll invite Ms. Wang to come up and continue with the Cohen's D, if that's okay.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
Just a little bit. Good morning. My name is Judy Wayne. Again, I am representing Kohler on the Cohen's D issue. As your honor is aware, Commerce's Cohen's D methodology is being challenged by litigants in no fewer than four separate pending cases before the Court of Appeals, before this court, and before the NAFTA panels. The through line of all these cases is that Cohen's D is a precise mathematical equation, and yet Commerce is ignoring all the statistical requirements related to that mathematical equation. This is not reasonable. Our case is the last to be filed in this series, and it is our position that the litigation on the Cohen's D issue of our case should be stayed pending the current appeal in the subcorporation case. And as your honor is aware, subcorporation is ongoing. It's one of the most comprehensive challenges to Cohen's D methodology. It was filed first, it's the furthest along, and the disposition of the Cohen's D issue in that case will directly impact the outcome of the Cohen's D issue in our case. As your honor articulated most recently in Highseal, to quote, promote uniformity and reduce legal uncertainty in a hotly contested area of international trade law, the Cohen's D portion of the litigation should be stayed. That same reasoning applies here. And so that's our position.
What is your latest information? We were checking the docket sheets on STUP, which I guess would be STUP 5?
Yeah.
Right. What is your understanding as to when the case will be argued?
So I know that the appeal was docketed in March 27th of this year, and the opening briefs were filed in July. I believe the government has requested an extension for filing the response brief, but my latest understanding is that the briefing is just still ongoing.
Okay. Thank you.
So now I'll turn to some of the arguments that we raised in our brief before then responding to some of the rebuttal points that Commerce has made in their written responses. The issue that we mainly challenge is that Commerce is availing itself of the Cohen's D methodology, but ignoring the explicit preconditions as stated by Professor Cohen of normality, variance, and numerosity. When this happens, the results of the Cohen's D analysis no longer have any inherent meaning. And we show this in our briefing through pages of formulas and graphics, and it's visually clear how different the graphs look when the data that is tested meet those criteria versus when data is tested that do not. And the difference is visible. And so again, put simply, Cohen's D is a precise mathematical equation, and yet Commerce is using this equation but ignoring all the statistical requirements explicitly laid out for this equation. And yet Commerce is still hoping that the results of Cohen's D provide meaningful information for the differential pricing analysis, and this is not reasonable. Now I'll turn to some of the responses that Commerce has filed, first on the issue of populations of the samples, and then on the relationship of Cohen's D to other parts of the differential pricing analysis. So on the issue of population versus samples, this is a red herring because the Cohen's D, again, is a mathematical equation. So it's agnostic to the type of data that is being tested. You could test samples or populations, but the data itself has to meet these explicit preconditions. And that's actually exactly what the court in step five, or step four, the most recent court at the Court of International Trade. The case specifically said parties devote a significant amount of their briefing to the discussion of the permissibility of using Cohen D on full populations and the question of statistical significance versus practical significance. Neither question is determinative of whether Commerce's methodology is reasonable. Both arguments have already been raised by the Court of Appeals, before the Court of Appeals, which concluded that it did not resolve its concerns over whether the absence of certain assumptions forecloses Commerce's use of that test. And this is citing to the step three holding in by the CAFC. And there the language is again clear, and it says, while Commerce is correct that it does not sample data, that observation does not address the fact that Professor Cohen derived his interpretive cutoff under the assumption of normality. And that's at the CAFC level, so that's the standing precedent. Commerce does cite to Marmon for its proposition that populations are somehow negating the question. But, Your Honor, this holding is actually inconsistent with the current step three holding at the CIT, at the CFC level, and the step four holding at the CIT level.
So is it the Marmon? Marmon opinion you feel is inconsistent?
Yes.
And what is the status of Marmon?
It is being appealed right now at the CIFC. And let me see what the latest. I think the opening briefs were filed in July of this year. So that appeal is pending, and it is our position that decision is inconsistent with court precedent. So then on the issue of the interaction between Cohen D and the meaningful difference test, as we laid out in our reply brief, these three tests, Cohen D, meaningful difference, and the ratio test, are administered sequentially. And so the results of the first test are then taken and fed into the next test and so on. So if you get faulty results from the first test, then those faulty results are compounded by the later test. They're not corrected. And so Commerce's proposition that somehow these cancel each other out is just incorrect. And we laid this out in our reply brief, and this issue is actually explicitly raised in the appellant of the Step 5 litigation that is ongoing. So the disposition of that issue will, again, affect the disposition of this issue in our case. And then finally, I just want to raise some of the ancillary issues that government raised in their brief. First, they talk about our references to academic articles in our brief. We weren't citing to academic articles. We were citing to the Step decision, language taken from the CIFC, a judicial opinion, which it cited academic articles, but laying out their reasoning for why they agreed that Commerce's methodology was unreasonable. So we weren't adding anything to the record, and we weren't citing to the articles themselves. They also claimed that we had not exhausted our administrative remedies with respect to certain arguments, and that's simply not true. In the agency proceeding, we challenged Commerce's use of Cohen D when these three preconditions were violated. That's exactly the same issue that we raise now. We've just supported it with mathematical proof as to why that's the case, but we haven't changed our argument anyway, and we've just provided further illustration of our scenario. And then finally, as to the rejection of certain of our exhibits at the agency level, it's our position that these exhibits do not contain any factual information. We simply used Commerce's program log and applied basic statistical testing to it. In Commerce's written response to Your Honor's questions, they themselves say that their program log does not contain factual information and consists entirely of calculations based on data already placed on the record. We only submitted their program log. So if they agree that their program log does not contain factual information, then that stands for our exhibits as well. And because our exhibits provide additional substantive proof for our claims, we believe that they should have been allowed to stay on the record. But more fundamentally, our claim is that Commerce did not test these assumptions in the first place, And so that alone renders Commerce's use of the Cohen C test unreasonable. And the absence of our exhibit does not change the veracity of our argument. And I am happy to answer any further questions you have, but that's my presentation.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Zachary Simmons, Steptoe & Johnson, on behalf of Kohler. The first issue I'd like to address is the issue of the inclusion of Blue Forest paper within the scope of the investigation. And on this issue, Commerce erred in its final scope determination by including Blue Forest paper in the scope for two principal reasons. First, Commerce's determination lacked the required substantial evidence basis. Second, by reversing its preliminary scope determination that Blue Forest paper is excluded from the scope based on the exact same body of record evidence, Commerce violated its own practice of not expanding the boundaries of the scope following the preliminary determination and without an amendment to the petition. In doing so, Commerce acted arbitrarily and capriciously. As to Commerce's lack of substantial evidence for its determination, Commerce identified no evidence other than an unsupported assertion by the petitioners for its determination that Blue Forest paper is within the scope of the investigation. This unsupported assertion purporting to clarify the meaning of the term thermal active coating within the scope language claims that a thermal active coating is typically made with the key ingredients of sensitizers, dyes, and co-reactants, or a light material, which is defined as any other form of thermal coating that serves the same function, namely to permit a thermal image to appear on the paper. This unsupported assertion cited no scientific or industry information and was the sole basis for Commerce's final scope determination. In particular, Commerce determined that the term thermal active coating could mean any form of thermal coating that permits a thermal image to appear on the paper, and that accordingly, Blue Forest paper, which includes a form of coating that, quote, serves the same function as thermal coating, was in-scope merchandise. Not only does this determination not stand on its own, the Commerce fails entirely to accord appropriate consideration to the substantial record evidence showing that, one, a thermal active coating requires materials that are chemically reactive to heat to form an image, and two, that Kohler's Blue Forest paper does not possess this kind of coating. As to the first body of evidence, both the petition and the U.S. International Trade Commission's preliminary determination made clear that subject thermal paper is coated with chemicals that react to form images when exposed to heat. As to the second body of evidence, Kohler submitted a visual diagram juxtaposing a thermal active coating with a fundamentally different coating that yields a physical change in properties to the paper utilized by Blue Forest paper. Kohler also submitted evidence showing that U.S. and German government authorities treat Blue Forest paper differently, both for environmental and intellectual property purposes, compared to subject thermal paper that includes chemically reactive materials. So for all of these reasons, Commerce failed to base its final determination in substantial evidence on the record. As to Commerce's arbitrary and capricious conduct, the agency violated its own practice by expanding the investigation scope following the preliminary determination and without an amendment to the petition. Since the initiation of the investigation, it had been understood, based on the scope language, that Blue Forest paper was excluded from the scope. This understanding, of course, was confirmed by Commerce in its own preliminary scope determination, which found that Blue Forest paper is excluded because it, quote, does not have a thermal active coating. But despite this understanding, and based on the exact same record information, Commerce completely reversed course and expanded the scope, finding that Blue Forest paper was in-scope merchandise for the final determination. In doing so, Commerce violated its own well-defined practice, as articulated in sodium hexametaphosphate from China and elsewhere, requiring that such expansions be executed through an amendment to the petition and prior to the preliminary determination. In the below investigation, neither of these conditions were satisfied. Accordingly, Commerce's inclusion of Blue Forest paper in the investigation scope constitutes arbitrary and capricious agency conduct. Your Honor, I'll now turn briefly to addressing the issue of dynamic sensitivity, in which we're defending the government's determination.
Right. And before you do that, looking at the government's responses to the oral argument questions, are there further questions that you want to address specifically?
On Blue Forest? No, I think most of the Blue Forest paper issues were directed to us.
Okay.
Do you have specific questions?
I do not. Oh.
Okay. So on the issue of dynamic sensitivity, petitioner's arguments boil down to two primary arguments for this issue, both of which should be rejected. The first argument is that Kohler's dynamic sensitivity testing was unreliable because it occurred after the initiation of the investigation. Here, petitioners have neither demonstrated a deceitful motive on the part of Kohler or that its testing had any methodological flaws. And with respect to the specific product, which we'll refer to as product B, that was the focus of petitioner's arguments, the relevant tests were actually produced in the normal course of business prior to the commencement of the investigation. Petitioner's arguments are thus completely unsupported and unfounded. The second argument that petitioners raise is that Commerce should have relied on certain specification sheets that Kohler had produced for certain products with respect to dynamic sensitivity instead of Kohler's test results. And here, the petitioners have simply failed to demonstrate that the product specification sheets were any more reliable than Kohler's test results. There simply is not that information on the record. Moreover, Commerce examined this issue. It looked specifically at the specification sheets and Kohler's test results and determined to rely on Kohler's test results because they were more contemporaneous. And therefore, Commerce fulfilled its obligations to examine the relevant record evidence and support its dynamic sensitivity determination. Finally, I'll address the issue of static sensitivity reporting. Here, Kohler provided extensive and unrebutted information on its product static sensitivity testing, and similar to the prior topic, petitioners have pointed to no evidence to support the assertion that the testing information provided was either incorrect or incomplete. Rather, Kohler reported static sensitivity information produced in the normal course of business, or if unavailable, for purposes of reporting such information to Commerce after the initiation of the investigation. Accordingly, Kohler's reported static sensitivity information reflected complete and accurate information produced using machines that were available to Kohler at the time of testing. There's no evidence to show otherwise. Second, and I believe as the government has argued in this case, there's no question that Kohler responded completely and accurately to all of Commerce's information with respect to static sensitivity, including in all supplemental questionnaires. Accordingly, there's no basis for finding that necessary information is missing from the record or that Kohler withheld requested information, failed to provide requested information by established deadlines, or significantly impeded the investigation. And those findings would be required to apply neutral facts available. For the same reasons, there is no basis for finding that Kohler failed to cooperate by not acting to the best of its ability in the investigation, which would be required to apply an adverse inference to the facts available. Though petitioners have asserted that Kohler could have provided additional static sensitivity testing information, petitioners cannot supplant Commerce's decision-making authority as to what they see are necessary for the investigation. And finally, there is additionally no basis for applying AFA because Commerce never identified any deficiencies with respect to Kohler static sensitivity testing information and did not promptly inform Kohler of the nature of any deficiencies, again, because there were none. So under the statute, under 19 U.S.C. 1677-MD, there is also no legal foundation for the application of AFA with respect to static sensitivity. And with that, I yield my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Uh, I actually have. I wasn't sure. Well, I just want to make sure that one question of the supplemental questions is addressed, and that's the so-called harmless error issue. I just want to make sure. I'm not sure who can address that, and that goes to question two of the supplemental questions. You may have already answered it. I just want to make sure that I missed that. Yes.
Sure, Your Honor. No, we don't think that this is a harmless error. The exhibits that Kohler submitted are provide further substantial proof as to our claim. And just because Kohler has provided other compelling reasons why Commerce's methodology was sufficient does not mean that Commerce should have excluded these exhibits, which are helpful for our argument.
So just so I understand, is it the position that in the absence of Kohler's rejected exhibits from the record do not impact the relief that Kohler seeks?
It does not change the veracity of our argument, no.
So what impact would the rejected exhibits have on our analysis if it doesn't? It seems like you're saying it doesn't matter.
The exhibits provide further proof as to Commerce's failure to test for normality. So they help further substantiate our arguments, and we believe that they were wrongly excluded from the record evidence.
Thank you.
Would you like to hear from the government next, Your Honor?
Yes, please.
May it please the court. I will first adjust the microphone and then start with responses to the court's October 30th questions and stay with those related topics as I go through them, and then I'll address the Kohler's responses and petitioner's responses to the prior questions that the court had.
Thank you.
The court's first question in the October 30th letter was about Mid-Continent Steel, and the question was, which type of average did Commerce use for the Cohen's D denominator in this case? And the answer is that Commerce used the simple average denominator. The court then asked, was this consistent with the Federal Circuit's holding in Mid-Continent? And if not, how would the inconsistency affect the litigation? There is no inconsistency because Mid-Continent is still a non-final decision. What the most recent Federal Circuit decision accomplished was to send the issue back to Commerce for further explanation. There has been no ruling that using a simple average denominator is unlawful as a matter of law, or any holding that Commerce could not provide a reasonable explanation for using it, and so that's why it's been sent back. Further, and most importantly, the issue has not been exhausted to Commerce in this case and also has been waived by not being raised in the complaint or during any of the briefing. As this court explained in the Dillinger case, simply because a party raises one challenge relating to the differential pricing analysis under Section 1677F-1, subsection D, does not mean that they have thereby incorporated all potential challenges to that issue, and the issue in Mid-Continent is different than the one that has been raised in this case. In Mid-Continent, the question, as the court acknowledged, is whether to use a weighted average denominator when there are different test sizes versus the comparator size. And in this case, the question is whether the challenge is whether Commerce can use the Cohen's D test at all when there are allegedly not normal distribution and different variance and size of the sample. So the issue has not been exhausted to Commerce. Commerce did not have the opportunity to provide an explanation, and that's really all that the court is saying Commerce must do in the Mid-Continent case is provide an explanation, and Commerce didn't have the opportunity to do that here.
Your position is that in any event, the issue is waived?
The issue is waived by failing to raise it in the complaint or at any point in the briefing. And I would also note that there have been two Mid-Continent cases from the Federal Circuit. The first one was in 2019, which was before the case briefs were filed in the underlying investigation and proceeding.
And the one referenced, the more recent one, is 2022.
That's right. So that is before the briefing was complete in this case as well.
So how does that cut? In other words, one can say that an issue is waived, and perhaps more comfortably, because I'm not suggesting an answer to this, if in fact there's case law on a subject and a party has not addressed the issue as presented in a case, but where a case has not been decided or is not on the horizon, how does that intersect with the failure to raise an issue?
Well, the parties have to raise the issue themselves, regardless of whether a case exists on the topic. For example, if the parties had not raised the issue in STUP, or as an example, in Mid-Continent itself, the STUP issue was not raised there, and the court did not address it. So regardless of what cases are pending or not pending, parties have the obligation to raise all issues, to exhaust all issues before Commerce, and then as a separate obligation to raise all issues they wish for the court to decide in their briefing to the court. So neither of them has been done, and that's really independent of what cases may or may not be pending. But certainly I think the fact that there were prior decisions simply confirms that they had every opportunity to raise this issue had they wanted to do so. They didn't. And there's no dispute in Kohler's responses to the court's questions that the issue in Mid-Continent is different than the issue that they're raising here relating to normality and equal sample size and equal variance for using the Cohen's B. So that's not been disputed. What Kohler instead argues is that Mid-Continent somehow supports its more general proposition about Commerce allegedly departing from statistical principles. But in fact, not only has that argument also been waived, but in fact that is consistent with the Federal Circuit's decision in STUP. What the Federal Circuit has required is a reasoned explanation. And in evaluating whether an explanation is reasonable, the court looks to the record that's been created before Commerce in any given proceeding, just like any proceeding for review before this court under the APA standard, and looks to the arguments that have been exhausted before Commerce. So in this case, Commerce reasonably explained that the differential price, the use of Cohen's D at the first step of the differential pricing analysis fits within the broader differential pricing considerations, and that's consistent with the court's decision in step four that has sustained Commerce's use of the Cohen's D in this situation. And in Marmon, the court also accepted Commerce's additional explanation that the difference between using the Cohen's D as an effect size for a complete population explains why the considerations or assumptions of normal distribution equal variance and equal sample size were not required. And here, Commerce didn't only provide the explanation that was provided in the past. It also, at page 6 of the IDM, for example, discussed the difference between the Cohen's D and the effect size versus the t-test, which is relating to statistical analysis. So this is exactly the kind of additional explanation that the STUP court invited Commerce to provide, and it was provided here. Very briefly on this day, this case is distinguishable, as we said, from High Steel because of the additional issues here. So the considerations of the timely administration of justice for the case as a whole support proceeding with the case and not issuing a stay. And since the court previously denied a stay, there have been now two decisions supporting Commerce's reasoning here. So there's even less of a reason to stay now than there was when the court previously issued the denial. On the new factual matter, Kohler has never disputed that this case presents the same issue as in STUP. Kohler is saying that, and we agree with the fact that Commerce's program log itself is not new information. The difference here and what the court explained, what this court explained in step two and the Federal Circuit sustained in step three, is that by putting new input into the program log and obtaining different results, that's the piece of the information that is new, and Commerce has the discretion to apply its own regulations regarding new information.
Are you disagreeing with the counsel's representation here, explanation as to what was put in or not put in?
I don't think we're disagreeing. They are, I believe, admitting that when it comes to Commerce's program log, they took the program log and put in different values that would reflect different assumptions. And that's the point they were making, was trying to show how different inputs would alter the results, according to them. And that's exactly what was the type of manipulations to the program log that were submitted in Stuck. That's part of the new information at issue in Stuck. And Kohler hasn't disagreed that Stuck is distinguishable in any way as to the new information.
Thank you.
And on the question of whether error is harmless or not, the court will be unsurprised to know that we don't think there was an error, but we do agree that because the review of this issue is based on the record that was created before Commerce. And so to the extent this would create a different record, we agree to the extent that the court looks to the record that's created in each individual case to assess the reasonableness of Commerce's explanation and what's been presented to Commerce to undermine that in any given case. So I suppose what I'm trying to say here is that the harmless error piece, we would agree that the review happens on the record. So the focus should remain on the record created in this case, not on the record created in different cases that may be pending. The court's next question from the October 30th letter relates to the scope of Blue Forest paper. And the court asked the government to respond to Kohler's statement that where it is understood at the initiation of an investigation and certainly by the preliminary determination that the scope of the investigation excludes particular merchandise, any subsequent inclusion of such merchandise in the scope would constitute an expansion. So the response is that there was no modification or expansion in this case at all. The scope language at the outset of the investigation in the petition was the same as the scope language in the order. And that includes the language of the thermal active coating. And Commerce simply found in the final determination that the thermal active coating includes Blue Forest opaque thermal sensitive coat. The plaintiff, so there was no exclusion at the outset that was later included later on. The Kohler's argument seems to be that because Commerce made a finding in the preliminary determination that the Blue Forest paper didn't fall under this category, and then after considering additional argument, issued a final scope decision at the end of the investigation, that somehow represents an expansion of scope. But that's not the case. The purpose of issuing a preliminary decision, allowing the parties to brief the issue and present their arguments, and then for Commerce to issue a final decision, is that Commerce can consider all the arguments. And in this investigation, Commerce issued only one final decision as to what the thermal active coating means and whether that includes the Blue Forest paper. So that is simply an interpretation, perhaps a clarification, but it's certainly not an expansion and not even a modification of the language. Even if it were a modification.
And we've read your filing. What's your home run case for that proposition?
I think the MS International case is the one that has both the helpful language of distinguishing the analysis between how to consider Commerce's discretion, inherent discretion, leading during the investigation and leading up to the creation of the order, compared with the analysis that the court often performs in scope cases, which applies after the order has already been applied. And I think even just looking to the regulation, 19 CFR 351.225, which relates to scope considerations after the order has been issued. That's clear. That's the question is whether a product is covered by the scope of an order. Here the question is Commerce's discretion in fashioning the order itself. So the MS International case and the DuFerco case, although the DuFerco case was a scope question, but it recognized Commerce's discretion to set the scope of the order. So that's a distinction that Kohler really doesn't recognize or tries to elide, but it's a really important question. And so the question for this court really should be, did Commerce act within its inherent discretion in setting this, in issuing its final scope decision in this case? It's not a K1 or K2 issue. It's a discretionary question. The court's last question in the October 30th letter relates to static sensitivity. Assume as a hypothetical that does not suggest any view by this court that the court remands Commerce's determination that Kohler's static sensitivity reporting was complete. Defendant intervener states that in this scenario, giving Kohler an opportunity on remand to correct its reporting would undermine effective enforcement of U.S. law. Does the government agree? No. If the court, in a hypothetical, were to find that there were a deficiency in one of Kohler's questionnaire responses, then the remedial and notice provisions under Section 1677M, subsection D, would apply, and Kohler has not previously been provided that opportunity because Commerce did not find that there was such a deficiency in the underlying investigation. Having answered the court's question, I would like to push back on the hypothetical, because there, the question of whether there...
Ouch.
But I'm happy to follow up on the hypothetical, too, if the court has further questions on that.
No, please.
The question of whether there is a deficiency in the record and whether there is necessary information is missing from the record are both discretionary questions within Commerce's expertise and discretion. And here, Commerce did not find that there was a deficiency in Kohler's questionnaire responses. And the question of whether there's necessary information missing from the record isn't a one-to-one of what petitioners are trying to point to of say, could you interpret this question a certain way? Commerce has the discretion to identify whether information is necessary to its determination. So here, Commerce did review in detail the Section B questionnaire responses and requested follow-up on the areas that it viewed were necessary, and those specifically related to products A and B, because those were the control numbers that Commerce viewed required clarification to just determine how to categorize those products. But this is not a situation where Commerce found that any necessary information was missing from the record, or that there was a deficiency. And petitioners haven't shown that that was an abuse of Commerce's discretion or clearly wrong on the record of this case. Commerce clearly gave a great deal of consideration to the Section B questionnaire responses and had a great deal of back and forth with Kohler on that topic, and Kohler provided responsive questionnaire responses. So to briefly, in my remaining time, go through the remaining issues. On dynamic sensitivity, this is a textbook substantial evidence issue. The petitioners are saying that Commerce should have relied on one type of evidence, the specifications, and Commerce reasonably relied on the testing information and explained in the IDM that the IDM and the analysis memorandum, that these were the most frequent test results. Commerce provided a reasonable explanation for that decision. On the rebate, there should really be an uphill battle here to try to argue that Commerce somehow has a established practice that departs from the preamble, the approach articulated in Commerce's own regulatory preamble to the regulation that's in effect now. And I haven't heard petitioners identify any explanation for the portion of the preamble explaining that Commerce did not adopt the more categorical approach proposed by the petitioners because that could, quote, have the unintended effect of limiting the department's discretion to accept certain post-sale price adjustments, which the department has previously accepted. So the hallmark of Commerce's final modification was discretion. That's why they adopted the multifactorial test. and Commerce applied those factors here and came to a reasoned and reasonable decision. On the last issue regarding accrued interest, we agree that the court asked the parties to assess the practical impact, and we agree with that practical impact. And where we continue to disagree with the petitioners is that Commerce has only provided conclusory analysis to this issue or has failed to explain itself. Commerce's path can reasonably be discerned. It explained in the issues and decision memorandum the reason why in these unique circumstances it chose to include the interest expenses in the calculation. And the problem that petitioners have is that nothing in Commerce's explanation, which was a couple of pages in the IDM, would support how petitioners now want to categorize this expense as being related to the sale of subject merchandise in this investigation during the period of investigation. And the calculation memorandum, as we explained in our briefing and responses, also explains why Commerce put the interest expenses in the cost of production area and excluded them from the indirect selling expenses. So Commerce's decision is supported by substantial evidence. It provided a reasonable explanation for its treatment of the interest expenses, and that suffices. So looking to the record as a whole, looking to the record created in this case and the arguments made by the parties, Commerce provided a reasonable explanation for each of the challenged decisions, and we ask the court to sustain the decision. I do have one more piece that I just remembered about the differential pricing that should take just one. I'll try to do it in 30 seconds. Kohler highlights the mathematical graph that they included in their brief, and they say that that's simply a mathematical representation of the arguments that were discussed in STUP. It's not. It's new information, and the fact that Kohler felt the need to present it simply highlights this is an area involving expertise. It's a complex area that falls within Commerce's expertise, and by failing to present these arguments to Commerce, they've not exhausted them before this court, but it highlights that Commerce is the appropriate body to be making these decisions, these complex decisions relating to the methodology for differential pricing.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Dan Schneiderman on behalf of Don Tarn Apfion. I'll start by responding to the court's October 30th questions, and then I'll respond to the answers of the other sides. The first question dealt with product coding and whether or not it's a correct statement that when the government identifies inclarity or incompleteness in product characteristic coding, whether it typically requests additional information. And we agree that it does. It is Commerce's normal practice when it discovers problems with condom reporting to provide an opportunity to explain a remedy. However, that's only up to a point. If it would be impracticable to correct the response in light of statutory time constraints and Commerce finds incomplete reporting, at that point, its general practice is to apply partial or, if necessary, total facts available. And I would cite for that proposition the recent case of Prosperity Thai versus United States, 965 F3rd, 1320 at 1328, which is a 2020 decision in which improper condom coding was discovered sort of late in the investigation and Commerce applied facts available. In this case, you know, we think it's clear that with respect to static sensitivity, that the reporting was incomplete. The questionnaire requires that Kohler report the temperature at which a product reaches its maximum optical density, or ODU, you might see it in the briefs. Kohler conducted testing for certain products in a way that would necessarily produce inaccurate results. It failed to measure the static sensitivity up to a sufficiently high temperature to determine where it reached the peak density. And by testing products differently, in other words, up to different temperatures, It essentially created artificial differences between two grades that where no such differences existed in reality. So, for example, you could have two grades with the same static sensitivity that were reported as being different because only one of the two grades was tested up to the maximum temperature. And also, conversely, it obscured real differences between grades. For example, you could have two grades with different static sensitivities that were forced to have the same result because Kohler failed them to test them up to a sufficiently high temperature to reveal the difference. And so with respect to static sensitivity, we have an incomplete record. And, you know, given the procedural posture of this case and how this issue arose, we don't think it would be practical for Commerce to send it back to reopen the record to have Kohler remedy this problem. And we think Commerce should have applied facts available. With respect to the court's question on rebates, didn't Commerce explain by considering the other factors its departure from practice? And I think, you know, our point on this, Your Honor, is that Commerce has established practice when you're dealing with what we call a post hoc rebate or a rebate for which the terms and conditions were not established prior to the time of sale. When that particular factor is satisfied, when you're dealing with a post hoc rebate, the established practice is to disregard the rebates regardless of the other factors. The other factors can become relevant when it's not a post hoc rebate, but when it is a post hoc rebate, Commerce doesn't consider the other factors. And so essentially, our point is that by definition, Commerce's consideration of those other factors cannot explain why a departure from the normal practice of not considering other factors was warranted. And we would also point out that even, you know, even if you disagree and think it's appropriate for Commerce to consider those other factors, in other words, that you don't think there's an established practice for them not to consider it, I mean, at the very least, those other factors should be fairly compelling and present a countervailing reasons why the rebate should be accepted, notwithstanding the fact that they're post hoc rebates. And we don't have any compelling findings in this case. And so, you know, here's what Commerce found. On the one hand, it said that Kohler's rebates were, quote, not uncommon. In other words, they're somewhat frequent. And they were of limited number. In other words, they were somewhat infrequent. And, you know, these findings are they're just very generic, for one thing. And on the other hand, they're self-contradictory. They really don't distinguish this case from any other case. You know, for example, we cited the plate from Taiwan case where a respondent had said, well, yeah, we have some post hoc rebates, but this is just our normal business practice. We do this all the time. It's not because we're trying to manipulate the dumping margin. And Commerce said, well, you know, that's fine, but it's a post hoc rebate. It doesn't matter whether it's your normal business practice. We're going to disregard it. Commerce also found in this case that the rebates were issued before the filing of the petition, and so therefore they weren't necessarily intended to manipulate the dumping margin. Again, that doesn't distinguish this case from any other. We said the TRVs from Korea and other investigations which involved the same factual scenario. The respondent said, look, these rebates were issued before the petition was filed. I wasn't doing it to manipulate the dumping margin. But nonetheless, Commerce said, well, it's our practice to disregard post hoc rebates. So none of the factors that Commerce here is citing distinguishes it from established practice. Again, which is when you have a post hoc rebate, it's disregarded. Commerce doesn't care about the other factors at that point. And then the court also asked us about whether Commerce has to explicitly mention the existence of its practice as part of its explanation. I think the answer there is yes, because any departure from existing practice must be made deliberately and with full understanding of that existing practice. If Commerce doesn't explicitly acknowledge the existence of the past practice, there's really no way to confirm that the decision represents a deliberate departure from past practice rather than just a misunderstanding of that past practice.
Is there a home run case that you cite?
We cited, and I think these are good cases, at pages 16 to 17 of our opening brief. It's the Pak Food case and the Tian Zian cases. That's spelled T-A-I-A-N. Ziyang. And those two cases, I think, make clear that Commerce errs when it departs from an existing practice without acknowledging that practice. In terms of responding to some of the points made by the other parties in their answers, on Cohen's D, I don't have much to add, really just 2 points. The first, on Mid-Continent, we agree with the government that the issue addressed in Mid-Continent, the denominator issue, is quite distinct from the arguments that were presented in Stubb and which were preserved here. The issue in Mid-Continent involved, you know, how the denominator of the Cohen's D coefficient should be calculated. That was not presented to Commerce below, so there was a failure to exhaust. It was not in the complaint that Kroller and Matra filed with this court, and it wasn't addressed in the appellate briefing. And so there was waiver. Our response is that Mid-Continent, at least the 2022 version of Mid-Continent, has no bearing on this case. In terms of, we also agree with the government that Commerce calculated the denominator in this case consistent with its established practice. And in fact, as the government said, Mid-Continent got remanded to Commerce for additional explanation, not necessarily to change their methodology. And I believe in August, just a couple months ago, there was a redetermination in which Commerce provided further explanation but didn't change its practice. So the denominator has always been calculated in the same way. And then with respect to Kroller's request for a stay, we don't oppose a stay. I think our only point on that is that we want to avoid piecemeal litigation. We think all the issues should be kept together. And so we want to avoid a situation where you remand it to address certain issues and leave Cohen's D to be resolved at a later date. We'd like to keep it all together. That's all I've got to say on Cohen's D.
So the pending stuff case is, let's say hypothetically, is not decided until June.
Hmm.
What would your position be regarding how this court should handle the case before us?
Well, as I said, we have no opposition to staying it. Whether the court would like to issue a formal stay, which lifts upon publication of Step 5, at which point the parties provide a joint status report as to what should happen next, that would be acceptable to us. Again, as long as it stays all the entire litigation and not just particular counts. I'm not even sure that a formal stay is required. I mean, the court obviously could just delay issuing the opinion until Step 5 issues, but... So, again, we have no objection to if it takes till June, it takes till June. We have no problem with that. I understand there are other issues involved. We don't feel those issues necessarily have to get resolved immediately. It can all be resolved together. So, on the scope point, the scope language is very broad. It covers, you know, all paper with a thermal active coating. And then there's sort of this parenthetical after that, which says typically made of sensitizer, dye, and coreactant and or like materials, right? So this is all, it's very broad. It covers any sort of thermal active coating. Yes, the coating typically is made of these chemicals or like materials, but the scope is written very broadly. And, you know, at the outset of an investigation, it's not uncommon for Commerce to ask questions of the petitioner as to, you know, what do you mean by this scope language? The petitioner controls the scope of an investigation, and Commerce typically likes to fashion its scope to further the intent of the petitioner. So it will often ask questions. What do you mean by this language? Do you mean to cover this product or that product? Do you mean for it to be in or out? And so it asks us a question about what do we mean by like materials, and we explain that we interpret that term very broadly to mean any sort of material that can produce a thermal image when exposed to heat. We weren't asked to provide documentation supporting that position. They were really just asking what our understanding is, what our intent is. And so there was really no need for us to provide evidence. The evidence of our intent is just that statement. I think the factual question that's presented here that requires substantial evidence is not what do we mean by the term, you know, thermal active coating, but it's whether the Blue Forest qualifies as having a thermal active coating, which it clearly does here. It comes down to the, you know, what do we mean by thermal active coating? Well, what's a coating? I mean, it's some material that adheres to the paper. The Blue Forest clearly has that. And what do we mean by thermally active? Well, it's it's activated by heat. It responds to heat by producing an image, which is exactly what the Blue Forest paper does. And there's no dispute as to that. So we think Commerce reasonably interpreted the scope of language, thermal active coating, to encompass the Blue Forest paper. And I do want to respond to this issue of, you know, whether or not Commerce expanded the scope. We keep hearing that Commerce expanded the scope. The scope language never changed from the notice of initiation, you know, what was in the petition to the notice of initiation to the preliminary determination to the final determination. Oftentimes you'll see cases where the scope language itself evolves and changes. And sometimes there can be problems when that happens, particularly when, if an exclusion is eliminated and the scope is broadened. That's not what happened here. The scope language never changed. And Blue Forest was always covered. Now Kurler is saying now that it had understood since the initiation that the scope excluded Blue Forest paper. But that's just demonstrably false. At the very start of this case, and the initiation notice, the parties were given an opportunity to comment on scope and model match. And Kurler made a submission. It submitted, it had comments on scope and model match. It never argued that Blue Forest should be outside of the scope. To the contrary, it filed model match comments. And model match, by the way, is just what are the subcategories of the subject merchandise? How should they be reported for matching purposes? In other words, every sale gets placed in the particular control number based on certain physical characteristics. So you have subgroupings of subject merchandise. And what Kurler proposed at the beginning of this case was that there be a subcategory of subject merchandise for thermal papers without chemical developer, right? So but by making the suggestion, Kurler is implicitly admitting its understanding that thermal paper without chemical developer is within the scope. And so I think it was clear, and Commerce actually accepted that suggestion. The model match itself has subcategories of thermal papers with chemical developer and with no chemical developer. And before Kurler filed its initial questionnaire response, it actually sought an exemption from having to report cost to manufacture Blue Forest at one of the two facilities that made the product. In other words, it had made Blue Forest at two mills, one of which was the primary one, one of which was the secondary one that I think made just very little. And they said to Commerce, look, we want to be exempted from having to report costs at the smaller mill. And Commerce said, that's fine, but you still have to give us all your information regarding Blue Forest at the main mill. And in fact, they did. Kurler reported its sales and its costs of the Blue Forest paper. So, you know, throughout this investigation, it proceeded as if the Blue Forest was within the scope of the investigation. It never relied to its detriment at any point on some sort of understanding that Blue Forest was out of scope. And again, Commerce didn't expand the scope. It just corrected a mistake that was made in the preliminary determination. And frankly, you know, under Kurler's theory, a preliminary decision that a particular product falls out of the scope can never subsequently be corrected if it's wrong, right? I mean, Commerce would be in a position where it could never correct a mistake in a preliminary determination, and you know that's clearly nonsense. Again, the plain language of the scope here covers all thermally active papers. That includes the Blue Forest, and so there was no expansion of the scope. With respect to the last issue is on the interest expenses. This is a bit of a unique issue. There were hundreds of millions of dollars of unpaid anti-dumping duties arising from Kurler's failure to pay, directly related to U.S. sales of thermal paper. Now, granted, it was under a prior anti-dumping order on thermal paper, but these are interest expenses that accrued during our current period of investigation. So they do relate specifically to this time period. And our argument was, under the statute, we think that these should be treated as a deduction from CDP on the sales side rather than included in the cost side. And I think we made some pretty compelling legal arguments why it should do so, but we never got an answer from Commerce, right? When I read the decision memo, I didn't see anything addressing this argument. The government is pointing to a statement in a calculation memo that, frankly, is just entirely conclusory. The statement essentially says that Commerce didn't treat interest expense as a deduction from CEP, but it doesn't explain why Commerce chose not to do so. It contains no analysis. It cites no authority. It doesn't even cite any sort of general rule or policy against treating interest as a price deduction. It doesn't address any of our arguments. And more than that, you know, when you look at the statement in context, it wasn't even intended to address our argument. The statement appears in a portion of the calculation memo dealing with the calculation of CEP profit. We didn't have any objection to the way CEP profit was calculated. I think the point of the statement was just to make a mathematical point, which is that because interest expenses weren't deducted from CEP, the denominator of the CEP profit ratio should exclude the interest so that there's an apples-to-apples, you know, application of the ratio to the expenses. We never had a problem with the way CEP profit was calculated. And we also think it's very odd that Commerce would choose to address, frankly, our very extensive legal argument in this case with a throwaway line by a case analyst and a calculation memorandum. The calculation memorandum, it's not supposed to be making policy or resolving legal questions. It's just the case analyst's technical notes as to how the decision memorandum, which does resolve legal and policy issues, was implemented in terms of computer programming. That's its function. You know, the actual decision makers, they don't sign the calculation memorandum. They probably never even look at it. And so, I don't even think the court should, that the deferential standard of review set forth in the statute should even apply to a case like this.
And what is your home run case? Again, I know there have been a lot of filings here, but the home run case that says that the court should not follow the deferential standard.
Well, you know, I looked for a home run case on this one, and I can't find another case, Your Honor, where something like this has happened, where the government is citing to something in a calculation memorandum that wasn't addressed in the decision memo. I've never seen that. I think that, and I guess the question will be, well, what is the standard review I should be applying if it's on a throwaway line in a calc memo, if it's not the standard set forth in the statute? And I'm not suggesting that it should be de novo review or that this court should be resolving the issue in the first instance. I think it has to be by Commerce. But I think what has to happen is that there needs to be remand. And there are a lot of folks with a lot of expertise at Commerce in policy and legal and in operations. And I think they need to sit down and actually look at this issue and resolve it, and then present you with some rationales that can then be subjected to substantial evidence review. And that was certainly not done here. If there's no further questions, looks like I've got 10 seconds left, so I'll leave it there. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks, counsel. So these have been very enlightening arguments, and since we're all here gathered, I will, give you each side 4 minutes if you'd like to respond to what you've heard.
I'll try to keep my short because my colleague just warned me that he needs time too. A number of issues. Number one, Mid-Continent, we agree that our challenge is fundamentally different from the issue raised in Mid-Continent. The core crux of that argument, though, is that when certain equations have conditions, so when you use a denominator and you're testing the simple average of two data sets with different sizes, that doesn't make sense. You have to take a weighted average. And so the court is realizing that there is mathematical reality to the equation that is being used. And so when Commerce is putting in data that don't meet certain requirements, then the outcome does not make sense. And that reasoning applies in our case, because when there is an equation, then you have to observe mathematical requirements associated with that equation, and they didn't do that here when they were using the currency analysis. Second, the government references step four and their estimation of population for example and t-test. I won't read the entire analysis and so forth, but there is a sentence specifically in that decision that says, Commerce improperly reasons that because there is no need for a Q-test, there is no basis for the assumption. This is not true. So we can include this language in the post-hearing, or, you know, if we get the opportunity to have a post-hearing filing. Number three, the program log, again, as Commerce itself states, the calculations in the program log are based on data already placed on the record. Any analysis that we did on the program log is based on data on that record. So their reasoning applies in equal instance in our case. The mathematical equations, again, step four has helpful language to that regard. In that case, the plaintiff made an argument about the exchange rates, and then in the proceeding, then provided specific examples of the exchange rates. The court there said these are the same arguments. There's no different argument, and that's what is the case here. On interest rates, again, the statute simply says interest rates are not they don't meet the statutory requirement of indirect selling expense. In this case, it's not the same order, it's not the same sales, it's not the same time period, not the same parties. So there's no relevance to the subject merchandise. Number six, post-stock rebates. The language specifically says Commerce can consider these factors on a case-by-case basis in light of the arguments and evidence on each record. That's what Commerce did. And then finally, on the issue of stay, we are okay with stay and everything pending the litigation and stuff. I hope there's
time. Thank you, counsel. 1 minute and 4 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. So all of my rebuttal comments pertain to the Blue Forest issue, so I should be able to cover them. The first issue raised by the government is really, you know, this is a matter of discretion for the government. But this court has recognized very clearly that discretion to interpret the scope is not unlimited. Commerce cannot do whatever it pleases. And you can see the Allegheny-Bradford Corp. versus United States case from this court, or the ArcelorMittal Stainless Belgium NV case from the Federal Circuit. Both of them very clearly bound Commerce's discretion. And of course, all determinations by Commerce must be based on substantial record evidence and cannot be arbitrary and capricious. We've demonstrated that its determination did not have a substantial evidence basis and was arbitrary and capricious. Second, there is a difference between clarifying scope language in an investigation and expanding it. The government points to the MS International case. Our facts are readily distinguishable from that case. There, they very clearly clarified an existing scope exclusion on crushed glass surfaces based on new factual information. In our case, they added a qualitatively different product to the scope after the preliminary determination. So that is a key difference. Also, as we briefed, Kohler never conceded in this case, not once, but Blue Forest paper was in scope. We reported cost and sales information for the sake of transparency. You can look at our Section B response. We stated that very clearly. And finally, the government says essentially that its preliminary determination as to scope was a mistake and that there was ambiguity with respect to the scope language. You'll find that nowhere in the determination. That's post hoc rationalization. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
I will be brief. As to the Collins D analysis, it's not a question of straight math. This is how Commerce is using a methodology to determine whether there is targeted dumping occurring, and the differential pricing, the Collins D is used as a tool and part of that analysis. And there's additional layers on top of that, as discussed in step four. So it's not the case that, as Kohler is arguing, that it's a question of straight math. It's the methodology that Commerce is using to interpret the statute. That's all within Commerce's discretion. As to the question of looking to step four to discuss studies or exchange rates, the point is that in step three, the court sustained excluding the exact information that was the exact type of information submitted in the case brief. So that is governing here. On the Blue Forest issue, the Kohler tries to distinguish MS International, MS International actually involved a change in the language of the scope. So that is actually to the other side. I mean, that our case, in this case, there hasn't even been a change in the scope language. So that's an even stronger basis for saying that the Commerce hasn't even modified anything. It simply has applied it to the Blue Forest paper here. And then last, I don't have anything additional to say on the dynamic or the static sensitivity. As to the interest expenses, Commerce did discuss the interest expenses at some length in the issues and decision memorandum. And although it's true that the place where Commerce explicitly discussed the indirect selling expenses was in the calculation memo, the court can look to the discussion in the issues and decision memorandum to assess Commerce's reasoning for including the expense at all. And Commerce's reasoning there is consistent with including that cost, that interest cost, in the cost of production, and it's not consistent with petitioner's arguments. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And finally, for the defendant, intervener.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yeah, with respect to the interest expense, I think you'll see if you look at the decision memorandum, yes, Commerce does address capturing that expense. What it doesn't address is how it should be captured. And we, as I mentioned, we presented an extensive argument below that it should be treated as a price deduction, not as a component of cost. That particular issue was not addressed anywhere in the decision memorandum, and it wasn't discussed anything other than a conclusory assertion in the context of the calculation memorandum. With respect to the product coding, I think it might be useful just to give the court a little bit of context as to how this issue arose. This is dealing with the static sensitivity and the fact that the testing was incomplete. When we first received Kohler's response, we noticed that products, and you keep hearing about products A and B. These are the main products that Kohler sells that were sort of driving the dumping margin. And we noticed that Kohler was reporting these sales as having different static sensitivities, despite the fact that when you look at their specification sheets that were published before the litigation, it appeared as if they had the same static sensitivity. So, you know, we asked some questions about that. Why are you reporting as having different static sensitivities? And it turns out, well, they said, well, we did some testing for purposes of litigation. We had to drill down with several supplemental questionnaires to find out that, in fact, the reason that they're getting different static sensitivities is because they are testing the two products on different machines using different protocols up to different temperatures, essentially forcing them to have different static sensitivities. Commerce saw this. Asked them to perform new testing and to revise its reporting, and ultimately agreed with us that the two products had the same static sensitivity. It only came to light in a second supplemental response that the same issue affected not just products A and B, which in that respect had been corrected, but infected other products as well. In other words, there were various other products where they did not perform the testing up to a high enough temperature. But at that point, now that issue has been discovered, and again, Kohler was aware of this problem because it had been asked about it in the context of products A and B, but it never corrected it with respect to any other products. When it became apparent to us right before the preliminary determination that this was still incomplete, at that point, there was no time for Commerce to send it back yet again to have them retest and recode these products. And so at that point, given that the static sensitivity reporting was incomplete, what Commerce should have done, we believe, was applied partial adverse facts available.
Thanks, counsel.
Thank you, Ryan.
Mr. Call. like to thank counsel for the excellent arguments and for really being so responsive to the various letters from the court. And as is my custom, I will provide counsel with an opportunity to file a post-argument filing. And the filing should not exceed 2,000 words. And it will be due on Monday, November 20th. So that concludes our proceedings. And wish you safe travels. And again, thank you very much for the very enlightening arguments in this case, which even for the cases that we hear, the complicated cases we hear, this is certainly a multi-textured case, and we really appreciate the arguments. So take care. Thank you.
All right.
Court stands adjourned.